はい。Andrew Lewis here. Coming to you from Biscuit Town. That's a good biscuit. Excuse me one moment. Scotch finger. Oh, that's a good biscuit. I think that's a new low in the podcasting professionalismness. I had half a biscuit and I thought I should wait until I eat this biscuit, until I hit record. And then I just kind of hit record anyway. Like, I just, my finger on my mouse was just like, nah, I disagree, brain. So there you go. Scotch finger. Do you guys have Scotch fingers in wherever country you're from? I'm sure everywhere in the world has Scotch fingers. If not, if Scotch fingers are like an Aussie thing, then everyone should move to Australia because they are the best biscuit. I'm sure they're not an Aussie thing. They're probably Scottish, if I had to guess. Damn, that's a good biscuit. Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we eat biscuits into the microphone. We're talking about part 3, chapter 20. What did you think of Vronsky's code? And also, War and Peace readers compare Vronsky, deciding love is more important than ambition, with Prince Andrei, who is much the opposite. I actually wrote must the opposite. I meant to say much the opposite. I Am Norwegian said, what do you think of Vronsky's code? I think that it's not Vronsky's code, but the code of the aristocratic St. Petersburg that he has picked up. It's a code allowing a vapid and hedonistic lifestyle, which worked great for Vronsky until he suddenly fell in love, actual love. Yeah, it was a funny old code, wasn't it? A lot of double standards, a lot of selfish, like, kind of self-preservation seemed to be embedded into that code. Simply Productive said, his code sounds like modern-day sensibilities. Honestly, I think it's depressing that this guy is balancing his books to pay back debt for frivolous things when I'm here with $4.68 left for food until Tuesday. I get that others pointed out how much work people put into getting a single ruble. That feels like our reality now. Hey, I feel that. I've done my fair share of the old, how am I going to live for the next week with just these silver coins in my pocket? I'm by no stretch of the imagination much further ahead than you there. So I feel your pain. Although I did have enough money to buy biscuits. So, you know, good times ahead. Scotch fingers, I think they're 80 cents for a packet. Oh, worth it. Absolutely worth it. Sorry that you're struggling there, Simply Productive. I really am. Pasta with Napoli sauce. Or I think American. Are you American? No, you're Canadian. Anyway, I think over your side of the world they call it a marinara sauce, but it's just basically red sauce, passata, and you got to cook it for a couple of hours, passata, to make it taste good, with a bit of garlic and a bit of onion and a bit of olive oil, and that's really all you need, and some pasta, and that'll get you, that's like less than a dollar for a good 4 or 5 meals, and it's so delicious. Bit of chili oil, if you got that. Parmesan, some people like a bit of parmesan cheese. That's my tip for living off of next to no money. Or just ask your family for food, which is also what I do. Like, drop in on my mom, drop in on my grandparents, drop into my brother's place. Oh, you having dinner? Yeah, I'll have a bowl. Yeah, cool. Swim said, the mama fishy said, I'm going to skip over Vronsky's code of conduct. Oh, hang on, I didn't finish that comment. I didn't finish Simply Productive's one. And in the meantime, the lowly poor rich guy has the funds to run off with his pregnant mistress. How giving of him. Yeah. We're so broke, aren't we, these days? Even 50 years ago. Like, you could have a household. And I don't want to go down this bitter rant because it's kind of the current moanings of my entire generation. But, like, our parents and grandparents complained that, like, one of them had to have a full-time job and how hard they had to work to support their own life and their wife's life and their three kids' life. And they purchased a property and they all had cars and food every day. And I talk about how hard that was. And it's like, well, why don't you just both get jobs? Like, you were able to buy a house with just one of you having a job. I don't know. I know it was a different time. But, geez. I feel you. I feel you. Their thoughts about broke, like their idea of working hard to set up a family is like easy mode, I think. Now, Swim said the mama fishy said, I'm going to just skip over Vronsky's code of conduct because it's just infuriating. Comparing Vronsky with Andre is just insulting to Andre. So no. Instead, I offer you this article on the benefits of a cold bath / shower. All right, that's a sharp turn into a very random place. Sharp turn. The benefits, 10 amazing health, but we're going down this rabbit hole because, hey, Swim said the mama fishy has gone to the effort to send us this link, pooladvisors.net/benefits-of-a-cold-shower. So let's go. Wait, before we get to the benefits of a cold shower, I would like to draw a comparison between Vronsky and Andre, because Vronsky is saying, you know, he was so ambitious and he throws it all away for love. And Andre is very much the opposite. He's got a wife, the lovely Lisa, pregnant, by the way, with his firstborn child. And he's so unhappy with that life that he thinks his wife is stifling his ambition, and he goes the complete opposite way. So it's like they start in opposite situations and then they cross into, you know, Vronsky's taken a hard swerve into, I want to be a family. Andre's taken a hard swerve into, I don't want to be a family. And one's moving away from his duties and the other one's moving towards it as a means of escaping the family. And in both cases, it's sort of the woman and their love, considering their love for them, that steers them down those paths. So there's a really interesting contrast between them. And I think it's quite honorable that Vronsky had this quite selfish code in place and was able to ditch that, right? And because of his love for Anna, if that's indeed what he did. Andre, great character, but the guy could have maybe seen a marriage counselor or something rather than running off to war, leaving his pregnant wife behind. So why, then, is here's a question. Why would someone have a cold shower? Did you know that taking a cold shower has wonderful health benefits? This is an official advertisement for cold showers. Cold showers are paying me for this. You've heard it right. While a warm shower helps relieve your tense muscles, a cold shower or bath also have its own fair share of benefits. It strengthens the immune system. You know, I don't think it does, but one of the latest medical research proves that people... Oh, this is a really bad grammar, this article. That people who are regularly taking a cold shower have less of a chance. Well, we've all got a limited chance of acquiring these things. Anyway, they've got a limited chance of acquiring colds, flu, cancer, or hemorrhoids. All right. So if you don't want cancer or hemorrhoids, or hemorrhoid cancer, then you should take a cold bath / shower. It aids sleep. Right, yeah, well, I heard that dropping your body temperature actually helps you fall asleep. And we think that because the bath is warm, That's why it gets us sleepy, but it's actually when we get out of the bath and our body temperature drops, it makes us sleepy. I've heard something along those. Okay, it alleviates stress and depression. And there's a funny picture under here of a girl in a bathtub just looking so relaxed, like she's got her head to the side and it's all cozy and her foot's up and she's got her eyes closed. And that is not, like, she doesn't look stressed or depressed, I'll give you that. But she also does not look like she's in a cold bath. Like, that's definitely warm water that she's in. She looks so comfortable. It improves the metabolism. Yep. It improves inhalation or deep breathing. What? Because it makes you breathe. Okay. It produces natural painkillers. It boosts men's fertility. It regulates body temperatures. It helps fight cancer, and it get rid of varicose veins. There you go. Then there's some instructions on how to have a cold bath. Look, I think we can all figure that out for ourselves. Wow. Hey, swim said the moment fishy. Look, can I just say, you've added so much value to this podcast right now. And everybody listening, your homework is before tomorrow. You got 24 hours to have a cold bath or a cold shower and report back, please. All right, I'm going to put this in the discussion prompts for today. Let me know, did you get cancer from it or not? The proof will be in the pudding. Simply Productive says, also wanted to add about the code, I think we could do a mini essay here about the changes in society and its views of hedonism versus religiosity, and how basically Vronsky is in many ways ahead of his time. I am going to reply to that right now, saying one mini essay, please. Smiley face. All right. That's it. That's the discussion done. Let's read another chapter. Hey, 21. And it goes for a long time. I mean, yay. I love this book. Chapter 21 goes like this. I have come for you. Your washing has taken a long time, said Petritsky. Well, is it done? Yes, it's done, said Vronsky, smiling with his eyes and twirling the ends of his mustaches carefully, as if after the order he had established in his affairs, any too vigorous or rapid movements might upset it. After it, you always look as if you come right out of a Russian bath, said Petritsky. I wonder if that's cold or hot. And I have come straight from Gritska, the name by which they called their commanding officer. They're expecting you. Vronsky looked at his comrade without answering, thinking about something else. Is that where the music is? He said, listening to the familiar strains now audible of brass instruments playing polkas and waltzes. What's up? Serpukhovsky, bless you, has arrived. Ah, I did not know, exclaimed Vronsky. His smiling eyes shone still more brightly, having made up his mind that he was happy in his love and having sacrificed his ambitions to it, or, at any rate, assumed that role, Vronsky could no longer feel envious of Serpukhovsky, nor vexed with him, for not coming straight to see him on reaching the regiment. Serpukhovsky was a good friend, and he was glad that he would see him. I am very glad. Demin, the CO, occupied a large country house, and the whole party were there together on the roomy veranda. In the grounds, what first met Vronsky's eyes were the soldier singers in their white linen uniforms, standing beside a cask of vodka, then the jolly healthy figure of the CO, surrounded by his officers. Having come out on the top step of the veranda, he was gesticulating, and above the noise of the band, which was playing a quadrille of Offenbach's, was loudly giving orders to some soldiers who were standing somewhat apart. A group of soldiers, a sergeant major and some other non-commissioned officers, came up to the veranda and at the same time as Vronsky. After returning to the table, the commander again came forward with a glass of champagne in his hand and announced a toast to the health of our late comrade, the gallant General Prince Serpukhovsky. Hurrah. Following the commander, champagne glass in hand, Serpukhovsky came down smiling. "You are growing younger every day, Bondarenko," he remarked to the ruddy-faced, smart-looking sergeant major, serving for a second term, who stood just in front of him. Vronsky had not seen Serpukhovsky for 3 years. He had matured and had grown whiskers, but still had just as good a figure and was just as striking, not so much for his good looks as for the delicacy and nobility of his face and bearing. One change Vronsky noticed in him was that quiet and permanent radiance which comes upon the faces of people who have succeeded and feel assured that everybody recognizes their success. Vronsky knew that kind of radiance and noticed it at once on Serpukhovsky's face. Bless you. As he was descending the steps, Serpukhovsky noticed Vronsky. A smile of joy lit up his face. He jerked his head backwards and raised his glass, welcoming Vronsky and showing by his gesture that he must first go to the sergeant major, who was already stretching himself and puckering his lips for a kiss. Here he is, exclaimed the commander, and Yashvin told me that you were in one of your dismal moods. Serpukhovsky kissed the smart-looking sergeant major on his moist, fresh lips. Gross. And wiping his mouth on his handkerchief, I'm not surprised, stepped up to Vronsky. "Well, I am glad," he said, taking him apart and pressing his hand. "You look after him," shouted the commander to Yashvin and went out to the soldiers. "Why were you not at the races yesterday? I thought I should see you there," asked Vronsky, examining Serpukhovsky. "I did come, but late. Excuse me," he added, and turned to his adjutant. "Please give order to distribute this money equally among the men." He hurriedly took 300 100-ruble notes out of his pocketbook and blushed. "Vronsky, will you eat something or have a drink?" said Yashvin. "Hey, bring the count something to eat. Here, drink this." The carousing at the house of the CO continued long. They drank a great deal. Serpukhovsky was lifted and tossed by the officers. Then the CO was tossed. Then the CO danced with Petritsky in front of the singers. After that, feeling rather weak, he sat down on a bench in the yard and began demonstrating to Yashvin Russia's superiority to Prussia, especially in cavalry charges. And the carousal quietened down for a moment. Serpukhovsky went to the dressing room to wash his hands and found Vronsky there. Vronsky had taken off his coat and was washing his hairy red neck under the washstand tap, rubbing it and his head with his hands. When he had finished his ablutions, Vronsky sat down beside Serpukhovsky on a little sofa in the dressing room and began a conversation of great interest to both of them. "I used to hear all about you from my wife," said Serpukhovsky. "I am glad you saw a good deal of her. She is friends with Varya, and they are the only women in Petersburg whom it is a pleasure for me to meet," said Vronsky, with a smile. He smiled because he foresaw the turn their conversation would take and was pleased. "The only ones?" asked Serpukhovsky, smiling. "Yes. And I used to hear about you, but not only from your wife," said Vronsky, checking the hint by a serious look. "I am very glad of your success, but not at all surprised. I expected even more." Serpukhovsky smiled. Vronsky's opinion of him evidently gave him pleasure, and he saw no reason to hide it. "I, on the contrary, I must frankly admit, expected less. But I am pleased, very pleased. I am ambitious. It is my weakness, and I acknowledge it." "Perhaps you would not if you were not successful," said Vronsky. "I do not think so," said Serpukhovsky, and smiled again. "I do not mean to say I could not live without it, but it would be a bore. Of course, I may be making a mistake, but I believe I have some capacity for the career I have adopted, and that in my hands power of any kind, if I ever possess it, will be used in a better way than in the hands of many whom I know," said he with the radiant consciousness of success. "Therefore, the nearer I am getting it, the more pleased I am. It may be so for you, but not for everyone. I used to think the same, yet here I am living and find that it is not worthwhile living that for that alone," said Vronsky. There you are," said Serpukhovsky, laughing. "I had begun by saying that I used to hear about you and your refusal. Of course, I approved of it, but there is a way of doing a thing, and I think that though your action was good in itself, you did not do it the right way. What is done, and you know that I never go back on what I have done. Besides, I am quite all right." "All right for a time, but you will not remain satisfied for long. I should not say that to your brother. He is a dear child, just like this host of ours. Hear him, he added, listening to the cries of hurrah. And he is happy, but that would not satisfy you. I did not say that it would. And that is not all. Men like you are wanted. By whom? By whom? By society, by Russia. Russia is in need of men, needs a party. Without it, everything is going and will go to the dogs. What do you mean? Burton Nev's party in opposition to the Russian communists? No, said Serpukhovsky, frowning with vexation at being suspected of such nonsense. Tout ça est un blague, which means all that is humbug. It always has existed and always will. There are no communists, whatever. But scheming people always have invented and always will invent some harmful and dangerous party. That's an old trick. What is wanted is an influential party of independent men like you and me. But why? Vronsky named several influential men. Why are not they independent men? Only because they have not, or had not by birth, an independent position, had no name, were not born as near the sun as we were. They can be bought by money or by affability and must invent a theory to keep their positions, and they bring forward some idea, some theory in which they themselves do not believe and which does harm, merely as a means of procuring government quarters and a salary. Cela n'est pas pour fin que ça, or that's all there is in it. If you happen to see their cards, maybe I am worse and more foolish than they, though I do not see why I am worse than they. Anyhow, you and I have one great advantage. We cannot be bought so easily, and such men are more needed than ever. Vronsky listened attentively, but it was not so much the meaning of Serpukhovsky's words that interested him as his outlook on these questions, for Serpukhovsky was already dreaming of a struggle with the powers that be and already had sympathies and antipathies in that sphere, whereas Vronsky's interests in the service was limited to his own squadron. Vronsky realized too how powerful Serpukhovsky might become by his undoubted capacity for reflection and comprehension, and by his intellect and gift of speech, so seldom met with in the society in which he lived. And ashamed as he was of the fact, he felt jealous. All the same, I lack the most necessary thing, he replied. I lack the wish for power. I had it once, but it is gone. Pardon me, that is not true, said Serpukhovsky with a smile. Yes, it is true, at present, to be quite frank, added Vronsky. Yes, it is true at present, that is another matter, but the present will not last forever. Perhaps, said Vronsky. You say perhaps, continued Serpukhovsky, as if he had guessed Vronsky's thoughts, but I say certainly. That is why I wanted to see you. You acted rightly, I quite understand it, but you must not persevere in it. I only ask you to give me carte blanche. I am not patronizing you, though why should I not patronize you? You have so often patronized me. I hope our friendship is above that sort of thing. Yes, he said with a smile, tender as a woman's. Give me carte blanche, leaving the regiment, and I will draw you an imperceptibly. I will draw you on imperceptibly. But try to understand that I do want nothing except that everything should remain as it is, said Vronsky. Serpukhovsky rose and said, as he stood before Vronsky, you say that all should remain as it is. I know what you mean, but hear me. We are both of the same age. It may be that in number you have known more women than I have. The smile of Serpukhovsky's face and his gesture show that Vronsky need have no fear, but that he would touch the tender spot gently and carefully. But I am married, and believe me that knowing only your wife, whom you love, as somebody once said, you can understand all women better than if you knew thousands. Yeah, you keep telling yourself that, buddy. We will come in a minute, Vronsky shouted to an officer who looked in, having been sent by the CO to call them. Vronsky was anxious now to hear the rest of what Serpukhovsky had to say. Bless you. Here is my opinion. Women are the chief stumbling block in a man's career. It is difficult to love a woman and do anything else. To achieve it and to love in comfort and unhampered, the only way is to marry. How am I to put to you what I think? And Serpukhovsky who was fond of similes, went on. Wait a bit. Yes, if you had to carry a load and use your hands at the same time, it would be possible only if the load was strapped on your back. and that is marriage. I found that out when I married. I suddenly had my hands free, but if you drag that load without marriage, your hands are so full that you can do nothing else. Look at Maznikov and Krupov. They have ruined their careers because of women. But what women? Said Vronsky, recalling the French women and the actress with whom these men were entangled. So much the worse. The more assured the position of the woman in the world, the worse it is. That is not merely dragging a load with one's hand, it is like wrenching it from someone else. You have never loved, said Vronsky softly, with his eyes looking straight before him and with Anna in his thoughts. Perhaps not, but another point, women are always more materialistic than men. Men make of love something enormous, but women are always terra terre etere, matter of fact. Coming, coming, he said, turning to a footman who had entered. But the footman had not come to call them, as Serpukhovsky thought. He brought Vronsky a note. Your man brought this from the Princess Tvetskaya. Vronsky opened the note, and his face flushed. My head has begun aching, he said. I shall go home. Well then, goodbye. Do you give me carte blanche? We'll talk it over another time. I will look you up in Petersburg. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Have your say about that chapter on the subreddit. Have yourself a cold shower. And I'm looking forward to checking in with you all again tomorrow to find out if we've all been cured of all of our ailments. I'm going to be doing it. I'm going to be having a cold shower tomorrow. So I will report back. Let's exchange notes. All right, see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.